What's up, you guys? Hope you're all doing okay. This is Jax, and you're listening to Good Old Days for our seventh show. These are really starting to fly by now. So today we are going to hear some more old country and then even more southern rock. So first we will check out a singer with their famous country song. Second, we will have some southern rock. Then we'll listen to a song by another southern rock group. And then we will take a short break from a mainstream country. We're going to take a break from mainstream country in general right now. And then we're going to move it back to bluegrass. So that's what's happening this morning. And now let's start off the show. So first up, we have Mr. John Denver, who was internationally known as a performer, a songwriter, actor, humanitarian, and an environmentalist. So bunch of things. And his career was huge, going through decades. And for that, he's received plenty of awards, and he was frequently honored. So let's go ahead and just listen to John Denver right now. Here's his song, Take Me Home, Country Roads.
Almost heaven, West Virginia, Blue Ridge Mountains, Shenandoah River. Life is old there, older than the trees, younger than the mountains, growing like a breeze. Country roads, take me home to the place I belong. West Virginia, mountain mama, take me home. Dark and dusty, painted on the sky, misty taste of moonshine, teardrop in my eye. Country roads, take me home to the place I belong. West Virginia, should have been home yesterday, yesterday. Country roads, take me home to the place I belong. West Virginia, mountain mama, take me home. Country roads,
so that was Country Roads by John Denver. So this song is tied to so many happy times for me, especially with my brother and my dad. If we're taking a drive and I play this and it's just like automatic to us, both of them will just join in and they'll start screaming the lyrics with me. And then it also happens at my parents' house too, which I sometimes feel a little bit bad about, because all it takes is just one of us to start singing and then you'll hear someone else like joining in, and then the last one out of our trio will always catch on eventually. And also kind of join the singing session that we have going on. And it sucks, my poor mom, because if she's home, we'll all usually be in like different areas when this happens, because someone will be in the kitchen, someone will be like in the living room, and then sometimes somebody will even be in the bathroom. So literally we cover like many corners in the house. So poor mom, like my mom, if she's home, there's just no escaping it, because wherever she goes, we're all spread out. So she's going to hear horrible singing no matter what. We get very like tactical about it. It's like, haha. So yep, that's how we annoy her. But yeah, this song is just one of those tunes that's in a way become a tradition for us. We just, when we hear it, all three of us just start singing it. It happens a lot with the Star Spangled Banner too. We also do that one where we like start singing and then we'll all join in. Kind of weird, but you know what? It works. So now all I have to do is just head over to West Virginia and drive through on a country road and belt that song out, and that will complete one of my tasks on my random list of things to do in my life. And I'm actually going to Virginia next year, knock on wood, I want to. So maybe I should just go missing for a few days and leave my family and just drive over into West Virginia. But I'll brainstorm that idea, because my thoughts never really, I don't know. You know how you picture, like, you plan something really cool in your head and then you get there and it's like, this really wasn't that, like, great at all. But so I'll definitely have to kind of think about that. I could use the extra planning. But enough about me and my really strange goals. So let's learn a little bit about John Denver. So before this, though, I want to clarify something. Denver is not technically classified as a country artist. However, he's not really put into a certain category either. He branches out into lots of different genres, and his music has appeared on several different charts. So quite a musical variety that he has going on, but he did reach the country and Western charts, and his musical areas were considered to be folk rock, pop, and then Western and country. So he might have not been a traditional country singer, but some of his music did reflect a country sound. So there you go. So Denver is from New Mexico. He was born there in 1943. And Denver's journey really started when he was a young boy. At age 11, that's when he got his grandmother's guitar, and that led him into some guitar lessons, and then he joined a boys' choir, and that kind of put him in the direction of wanting a career in music. So that really was the factor that just kind of pushed it and was like, no, like, you know what? You like music. You want a job in it. So when he was 20, he went to Los Angeles here in California so he could be in the center of the music scene at that time, because, you know, around that year, that's really the heart of the music industry. And I mean, it still really is. So while he was in LA, he changed his name to John Denver, and he was getting plenty of encouragement to do that. And he did it in hopes of getting a recording career in the near future. By the way, he wasn't born John Denver, he was born Henry John, Lord help me on this pronunciation, Duchendorf Jr. Henry John Duchendorf Jr. So very smart decision, I think. Not that his name isn't cool or anything, but with a last name like that, it might be a little difficult to kind of spread the word. So it might have been necessary, because can you imagine how hard it would be if someone was like, oh, I heard this really good singer last night, like, oh, what's his name? Oh, his John Henry Duchendorf. Like, oh, wait, what's the last name? Duchendorf. How do you spell that? Like, I don't know. D-U, blah, 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 blah. So, good call. In general, John Denver is very easy to remember. And what he did, so he just took his middle name, pretty much, John, and then he took the capital of his favorite state and home to the Rocky Mountains, Colorado, and that was how he got his stage name of John Denver. So, there's so much to tell, but I'm going to do my best to give a good kind of synopsis and give you the main points, which I actually suck at, but here I go anyways. So let's start off with what is thought to be his first break in the music world, which is when he was chosen for the lead singer of a group called the Mitchell Trio. And during this time with Mitchell Trio, he started to develop as a songwriter and not only a singer. So when the group kind of disbanded and they officially separated, he kept it going, and he just turned that career into a solo artist kind of thing. And when he was releasing songs, I mean, he started really releasing his hits at that point. He had Country Roads, and he was getting like onto the charts, and they were giving him the title of one of the biggest stars in the 70s. So already he was having, you know, really good success. And later on in this decade, John Denver started to get attention with his social and political beliefs. And this is kind of interesting because so far we've had, I mean, I'm sure all artists through their lifetime have had some type of connection maybe with like either social or political issues. But John Denver was really the one, maybe like the only artist that I can really think of off the top of my head that has had, I mean, there's kind of Willie Nelson actually and kind of Charlie Daniels anyways, but John Denver is the one right now that we're talking about. And he really was the only artist out of a handful that I feel like really, really made his opinions very clear and very concrete. And he would kind of share like numerous environmental messages with his music. And the first of the pack being from a song called Whose Garden Was This? And John Denver just went on to use his talents for benefiting like charities and environmental issues and stuff. And because of his work with all of that, he was actually honored with numerous humanitarian civic awards over the years. And John Denver had something really cool going on. He had this way of kind of bringing the desire of ecology and peace and compassion on his records, which, by the way, was like kind of, I feel like sometimes it's harder than it seems, because especially since these are such, I hate to use this word, but like cliche kind of things, because I feel like a lot of the times, like even I'll do it, if people start being like, oh my God, we should all like be peaceful and compassionate, it's like, oh my God, like we've all heard this before, yada yada yada. But like, so I think it's hard to really put that in a song and have people actually hear it and like soak it in and take it seriously and not kind of roll their eyes at it. So he was doing this like through his records and his live performances, and he frequently delivered those aspects, and his fans were able to respond and they felt those messages, and pretty much they all reacted really, really well. And by doing all of this, that's when he established an international following, and he created like a global community almost that brought him new musical experiences with plenty of other like geographic places. He kind of went all over. He went to China, and then before that he was invited by the Soviet Union of composers to perform in the USSR. And then he went back to, let's just say, I'm just going to call it Russia because it's, that's what it is now. So he ended up going there again, and he did a benefit concert in 1987. So really, really awesome stuff. And he was the man for going to, you know, all these new territories, and he had that adventurer thing going on, and his journey just took him across the world. So I'm sure he loved that. I mean, as an artist, it's kind of amazing. And there's more, because he wasn't incredible enough already. He was an experienced airplane pilot, and he collected a few planes, actually. He also passed NASA's exam for mental and physical fitness that's required for space travel. And I want to watch Armageddon now. Every time someone says NASA, this is a weird connection, but every time someone starts talking about like rocket ships and NASA, I'm like, oh, Armageddon. And after, so anyways, after taking the examination, he actually became a possible candidate to be the first civilian in space on the Space Shuttle Challenger. And he had the idea of like even writing a song while he was up in space, but that did not happen because it exploded during takeoff in 86. It like broke apart in less than 2 minutes or something after takeoff. So it's a good thing that he didn't end up going on that mission. But, you know, his fans, of course, were a little bummed out. But what can you do? So sadly, and that's why most people, I feel like whenever I tell that story, they think like that's when he passed away. But unfortunately, his journey was cut short when he died at 53 on an airplane. He was taking one of his planes out and he crashed near Pacific Grove in California. He was the only one in the plane. He took it out for a solo fly, and he was testing some touch and go landings, and he was killed from the crash. So there's definitely, I know, I think I realized this, I can't remember if it was show 6 or the one before that, but there's like a pretty horrible pattern that we've been having on these shows. Like plenty of people so far have been dying from plane crashes. So lots of sad stories and deaths from planes. Despite his tragic death, though, John Denver's music remained relevant even after he died, which is incredible. And he still has old fans and he has new fans. My dad and I are living proof of that. And my dad's almost 70 now and I'm 21. So yeah, his fan base is really, really spread out. And he still inspiring those who listen to his music. And a little over 7 years ago, I think we'll go with seven, lucky number. So Colorado Senate actually passed the request for making John Denver's popular hit from 1972. It was Rocky Mountain High. They made it one of Colorado's official state songs. So now it's Where the Columbines Grow, joined by Rocky Mountain High. So just to prove that even after he's been dead for, you know, quite some time, he's still able to have a really strong pull through his music. And that just about wraps it up with Mr. John Denver. What a stand-up guy. Really, he did like a lot of things. It's kind of awesome, I feel like, when people start off with one certain career like he did with music, and then he just kind of like spreads it into all of these other departments. So really, really awesome. And now we have our first Southern rock singer for the show. This guy's music isn't technically categorized into the Southern rock genre, but you know what? He was born and raised in the South, and he is an extremely influential figure in rock in general. So therefore, I'm playing him for some Southern rock. So I like how I have to defend it. So this artist is definitely the one that I have been listening to for the longest time, mainly because he is my father's favorite singer of all time. I'm pretty sure like he was probably the first official guy I heard singing besides Barney. That's how like little I was. Like, you had Barney and then came Elvis Presley. So I grew up listening to Elvis. I grew up with him. He's like part of the family by now. I remember when we would like always decorate the Christmas tree from when we were little, even till now. And we would always play like Christmas kind of records, and Elvis would be one of them, singing a bunch of Christmas songs. And my dad always listened to him when I was a kid, and he'd put on Elvis, like an Elvis record or a CD, and I would dance around. I'm pretty sure we have so many home videos of me just dancing around to Elvis Presley songs. And what me and my brother used to do actually when we were little is we used to kind of go through all those Elvis songs and we'd pick one. We'd do this with like pretty much every single thing, Backstreet Boys, NSYNC, whatever. But I always tell the story with the Elvis CDs because it's a little less embarrassing. Makes us look like we have good taste. And so we played songs and we would like dance and we'd have competitions between us. So pretty much like I would be sitting on the couch and I would watch my brother. And then when the song was over, I would be like, you know what? Like, I think that move was so good, but it would have been better like if you kind of twirled around like quicker. And then he would do the same exact thing for me. Like, I would go like switch places and I would dance, and then he would be my little like critique with constructive criticism. And it was actually like, I don't know how old we were. My brother's 3 years younger than me. So I think I had to be like, I think six. I really hope it wasn't older than six, or else that's kind of like, because I feel like that's the age where you should stop doing that kind of stuff. So I was six, so that would make my brother 3 or whatever. So yeah, we had plenty of songs involving Elvis. And even when I was a little girl, still even now, my parents had tons of CDs just in general, and they could have opened up a museum. I swear to God, we've been like organizing a shelf for that since I don't even know how long. So whenever I got bored, I'd also like sift through all the CDs, and I had this thing that I would do. I still really do it. I'd open the cases up and like look through. You know how they have the little packet in front of like the CD, its cover kind of thing? So just for the fun of it, I would open it up and like look through, because sometimes they had pictures of the artist or song lyrics. And with that weird hobby, I quickly realized just how many Elvis Presley CDs my dad and my mom had, like enough to classify them as obsessed. And now that obsession has spread to me. So thanks, I guess. Could have been worse. And then actually, just a few days ago, I was watching Forrest Gump. And if you guys have seen this movie, towards the beginning of it, when Forrest Gump is still a young boy and he still has the braces on, and then there's that part where he narrates it and Forrest is like dancing with the leg braces on, doing the signature Elvis dance, and then there's a guy in the room with him who's playing the guitar, and they don't show his face. They're very sneaky about it during the scene, but you hear him talking, and he has the Elvis voice. Like, you can spot the Elvis voice wherever. So it's pretty obvious that the dude playing the guitar is supposed to be Elvis Presley. And then after that little scene, like Forrest Gump is walking with his mom, I think, on the street, and they see a bunch of TVs in the store window, and he sees Elvis like performing on the TV, and he's doing the dance that he was doing for him. And you know which dance I'm talking about, the knees bent and on the tiptoes, and kind of looks like people gave you a bunch of dead legs and you're just dragging them around and shaking around and grooving and all of that. So, yep, I freaked out. I was like, oh my God, do you remember? You remember this scene, you guys? I can explain who it is. pretty much everyone pieces it together. So let's go ahead and have just a quick listen to a song called Blue Suede Shoes by the extraordinary Elvis Presley.
Well, it's one for the money, two for the show, three to get ready. Now go, cat, go, but don't you step on my blue suede shoe. Well, you can do anything but take me over my blue suede shoe. Well, you can knock me down, step in my face, slander my name all over the place. Well, do anything that you want to do, but not, honey, lay off them shoes. And don't you step on my blue suede shoe. Well, you can do anything but take me over my blue suede shoes. Let's go, cat! My car, drink my liquor from an old fruit jar. Well, do anything that you want to do, but honey, lay off of my shoes. And don't you step on my blue suede shoe. Well, you can do anything but lay over my blue suede shoe. Lock it. For the money, two for the show, three to get ready. Now go, 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 but don't you step on my blue suede shoe. Well, you can do anything but take the help of my blue suede shoe. Well, it's blue, blue, blue suede shoes. Blue, blue, blue suede shoes. Yeah! Blue, blue, blue suede shoes, baby. Blue, blue, blue suede shoes. Well, you can do anything but take hold of my blue suede shoe.
So that was Blue Suede Shoes by Elvis Presley. And I love the song, but I've never had that feeling over a single pair of shoes. I'm like the type where if I get new shoes, I have to go like out into the front yard and then just put a bunch of dirt on it and like run them over with a bike. Cause I don't like it when when shoes stay, do you know what I'm saying? Like when they're brand new, it just looks weird to me. So, now I know I've complained before about how usually no one knows the songs or the artists that I listen to, and I definitely have never had that problem with this guy, because I mean, really, if you don't know who Elvis is, then it's kind of appalling. That word makes me feel like I'm British when I said that, but really, I'm the closest thing to a hermit. I'm not even kidding. I could live under a rock and I still know who the king is. So I feel like most of the entire population knows the name Elvis Presley. And this guy was like a phenomenal kind of dude. He was talented, he had charisma, and he was humble and kind. And his looks, I mean, must I go into this? I mean, it makes you wonder when someone is that like handsome, it just makes you wonder how his parents looked like, because they had to be the most gorgeous people ever to like give birth to a child that looked like that. So very good genes for Elvis Presley. It's not fair. He was too good looking. Anyway, so he had a lot of success, and he's known all over the world by just his first name. And that's really made him one of the most significant people in the 20th century in its popular culture. So now we're going to start at the very, very beginning. So Elvis Presley was born in 1935 in Tupelo, Mississippi. And he had a twin brother, actually, but he was stillborn, so he grew up as an only child. And Elvis grew up in a very close-knit family. They worked really hard, and he had his grandparents and uncles and aunts and cousins all around him since they were all living in Tupelo. And already as a young boy, he was picking up sounds from bluesmen around the neighborhood and plenty of country music radio programs. So when he was 11, Elvis wanted a bicycle, but his parents couldn't afford it, so his mom was able to convince him into having a guitar instead, and he ended up going for it. So That's a good thing that she was able to have him settle for it. So when he was older, Elvis and his parents, they moved to Memphis, Tennessee, and he graduated high school from there in 1953. Well, that rhymed, Tennessee, 53. So he grew up and he had a lot of musical influences around him. He was inspired by pop and country music with some gospel music that he was hearing in church. And then in addition to that, he was also picked picked up on really some R&B music in Memphis during that time. So plenty of outside influences. And 1 year after graduating high school, Elvis started his career in the music industry with the Sun Records label in Tennessee, which was soon sold to RCA Victor. So his recording contract was switched at that time. And he began his singing career in 1954 officially. And by 1956, he was an international sensation. And Elvis just brought in and introduced a completely different style of American music. He had a whole new sound and a whole new style, and he brought all of his kind of musical inspirations, and that really made a very unique combination. Now, besides becoming a music icon, Elvis Presley also became an icon on the big screen. And besides appearing on like TV and specials and stuff, he starred in more than 30 films. And usually I feel like this is kind of a rarity, because I feel like most of the time, if you are a famous singer, then they'll put you in a movie or vice versa. You know, if you're a famous actor, maybe they'll be like, I wonder if you can sing, or like maybe you have to sing for a role or something, and then that turns into like an album if people like your voice. But I feel like sometimes it doesn't really work like that, you know what I mean? Like sometimes a singer will be put in a movie and it's just like, ooh, like you can tell they're only there just because they're famous, like there's no acting skill whatsoever, and it's super just like it doesn't look right. But Elvis, I mean, obviously was super successful in it because he starred in 30 films, like I said. And I know I haven't seen all, I think there's 33 of them in total, but I saw Paradise Hawaiian Style, Harum Scarum, Viva Las Vegas, and Blue Hawaii. So I have a lot more to go. And these movies, at least the ones that I've seen, are so old. They're from like the 1960s, I think. And just watching it, I mean, I'll still like to watch it just because I think it kind of blows your mind a little bit. Like just to see how much like movies have changed. Because I would watch like Harum Scarum and then be like, oh my God, like you compare it to the Avatar, like some crazy movie now. And it's just like, what? Like, how did they even get to where they are now? So very, very cool. And for most of his movies, actually for most of Elvis's movies, he recorded some of the soundtrack as well. So he pretty much was like a double whammy for the producers and the directors, because he was killing like two birds with one stone. You know, he was an actor and he was a singer, and he'd star in the films and then he'd go and do the music for them. So pretty good. And as for his accomplishments, he sold over 1 billion records. That's more than any other artist, by the way. And in America, those sales earned him gold and platinum and multi-platinum awards. And in addition to that, he had 14 Grammy nominations, and he actually won 3 out of those. And when he was 36 years old, he won the Grammy Lifetime Achievement Award. I'm stressing the word lifetime because that's a really, really long time. And Elvis Presley also was named as one of the 10 outstanding young men for 1970 by the United States JCs. It's the U.S. Junior Chamber. So now in 1958, Elvis actually took a break from the music kind of industry and the movie industry as well. And he went into the U.S. Army, and he was then sent to Fort Hood in Texas, where he completed his basic training. And then for 6 months, that's where he was stationed. So before the Army, he was working on King Creole, and that was his, I believe it was his fourth motion picture. And while he was on his first leave, King Creole premiered, and it brought him some great reviews as an actor. This movie is actually thought to be his best film, and it was recognized for being his best acting performance and showing that he really did have true potential, not only as a singer, but like I was saying, it kind of showed that he could be taken seriously as, you know, an actual legitimate actor. And after that, a lot happened while he was stationed in Texas. And during that time, his mom got sick, so he was granted emergency leave, and he went into Memphis and stayed with her for just a few days until she passed away. And after she was laid to rest near Graceland in Tennessee, Elvis returned to Fort Hood. So soon after his mother's death and his visit to Tennessee, Presley was sent into Germany, where he was restationed in Friedberg for more than a year. And while he was there, he found that the fans in Europe were just as excited as the ones back home in the United States. And I think that kind of maybe brought a more homey feel to him, just because even though he was like across the world and in a whole different country, I feel like having just fans there who knew him and loved him, I feel like it may make it like it made it a little bit better of an easier switch, like less adjusting, just because it kind of felt like maybe he was still somewhere recognizable. So in Germany, he had an off-base residence with his dad, his grandmother, and a few Memphis friends. And then we're in 1959. So during that year, a captain from Texas relocated to the Air Force base near Friedberg, and he came over into Germany with his wife and children. And one of those kids was his stepdaughter, Priscilla. And eventually her and Elvis met. I think she came over to his house or something when they had like a get together, like a party thing. And the rest was history. And that is Elvis for today. We'll go ahead and end it on that note, and definitely we'll be coming back to the King in the near future. But for now, we'll be moving on to our next Southern Rock song for the day. But first, let's take a short commercial break, and then we will be right back.
Hey guys, Harley D here with your 3-minute break. 3 minutes of the wildest, weirdest, wackiest news to get your mind off your day. Let's get it started. Eva Lenfest of Maine made an almost life-ending mistake last week while driving. The 92-year-old woman mistakenly took a boat launch ramp for a road. Officials said that both the ramp and the surface of the water were covered in a layer of leaves, and Lenfest later said she had thought she was driving on the road. There was also heavy rain that morning, which further decreased visibility. Two men working in the harbor were able to get to the car in a rubber dinghy and pull Lenfest out. She was taken to the hospital, but is reportedly doing fine. A 37-pound house cat in Southern California has drawn national attention for his extreme size. The cat, aptly named Biggie, has been adopted by a Riverside cat hospital after its owners expressed that they could not afford the cat's high vet bills. The owner had initially brought the cat to the hospital after concerns the cat had not made a bowel movement. According to the hospital, Biggie is suffering from severe constipation that could require surgery. Veterinarians are planning to place Biggie on a weight reduction program. The hospital is asking for donations since Biggie's costs have gone up. To donate, visit GoFundMe.com/Biggie. 58-year-old Maria Montanez Colon was arrested this past week for abusing the 911 system in Florida. She allegedly called police with a bogus story that she had given her late husband's convertible to his son while she was drunk and she wanted the car back. When the officer arrived, she tried to have sex with him. Officer Justin DeVolt of the Punta Gorda Police Department arrived at the house and Montanez Colon allegedly fondled him. She allegedly grabbed the cop's arm and tried to rub her hands across his chest. So he told her that her behavior was inappropriate. She replied, "I know, I'm bad." The officer left, but returned a short time later with another officer when the suspect called 911 again. Montanez Colon was immediately booked into Charlotte County Jail. A 39-year-old woman in southwestern Michigan was arrested early Sunday morning at the Van Buren County Jail. She had apparently mistaken the jail parking lot for the Pawpaw Bar where she was picking up her boyfriend. The county police spotted the woman backing into the parking lot around 2 a.m. They smelled alcohol and noticed she appeared intoxicated. A breath test showed she was more than twice the legal limit. I'm Harley D signing off. This is radio.dominican.edu.
And we're back to good old days here on Penguin Radio. So now we are going to be visiting a band that we have already heard a little bit of. And I played some Molly Hatchet for you guys for our second show for Good Old Days. And I told you about how they got their name and the band's first and original lineup. And then we talked quite a lot about Danny Joe Brown, or like you may remember him, DJB, and his musical career and, you know, his life as a founding member. And then we ended it with the current members of Molly Hatchet. So now we are picking up where we left off. So let's go ahead and listen to a song of theirs. Here's Devil's Canyon by Molly Hatchet.
This canyon's gonna burn like hell.
right. So once again, that was Devil's Canyon by Molly Hatchet. Oh, I love that song so much. And I absolutely love these guys. I've said it before that my first true Southern rock love was Lynyrd Skynyrd. But now Molly Hatchet is second on that list. And it's like basically, it's like almost a tie. I can't even begin to explain how much I love Molly Hatchet. And since it is an older band, but because they are still like actively touring and they have new members and new lineups, and I can always see these guys perform, like it's an option. But even though it's totally a possibility that I can go and see them, there's just one little setback and one problem that keeps reoccurring and repeating itself. And that issue is that there is nobody who would want to go with me because, okay, while that may sound like I have no friends because I can't find someone to go with me to a concert, that's not the case. I do have some friends, enough friends to not classify me as like antisocial or a loser. So the real problem is that I have no friends, absolutely nobody's that actually listen to these bands. So I don't even know, like, I don't even think they know a single Molly Hatchet song, or they've never probably even heard of Molly Hatchet. And because of this, I think I finally resolved the situation. Because my friends can't go and no one my age that I personally know has any idea who these guys are. So it came down to going to a Molly Hatchet concert with none other than my parents. This is who I ended up, like, I would like think of everyone I knew and I was like, so who could I possibly ask to go with me? And then like pretty much all my friends were out of the question. So I was like, huh, mom and dad. So first I started brainstorming with my dad and I was like, okay, so if I took my father, there would be the possibility that he would either fall asleep or he'd probably be like, oh, like I'm going to go get a beer and I'll be right back, I swear. Or like, oh, I'm going to go to the bathroom. And then he'd end up just taking a walk and not coming back until the whole thing was over. Or he'd find like some random person outside that he would just get in a really intense conversation with and just forget all about me listening to Molly Hatchet. So my father's out of that. So it leaves me with my mom. So I will be going to a Molly Hatchet concert with my mommy. I guess I kind of forced her to go with me. Like I guilt tripped her into it. But you know what? Eventually she offered. So technically I didn't make her do anything. And that is the person I will be going to a Molly Hatchet concert with. And I'm fine with that. I'm happy. So you guys are just going to know my whole like life plan by the end of all these shows. So now on to Molly Hatchet and more modern news. I quickly mentioned the recent members of the band. They are Bobby Ingram, Phil McCormick, Dave Flubeck, and John Galvin, and then Tim Lindsay and Sean Beamer. So for this show, I kind of wanted to check out each individual like a little more, I was going to say deeply, but that didn't sound like a proper sentence. So I just want to kind of talk about all the new members on that lineup. So here's some short biographies, again with my not so awesome summarizing skills. But first up, we have Mr. Bobby Ingram. He was born and raised in Jacksonville, where the band originated from, and he first picked up a guitar when he was 11 years old. What? Oh, hold up. Yep. Did you guys notice that? Because we had John Denver, who got the guitar at 11, and Elvis got a guitar at 11, and Bobby Ingram now at 11. So good number. Isn't that one where people are like, oh, make a wish if it's like 11, 11? Whatever. It's not the same thing, but make a wish if you want. So he kept on playing music all throughout college, where he earned his bachelor's degree in accounting, strangely enough. And in 1968, that's when he started a band called Rum Creek. And that's the one that Danny Joe Brown was also in, and we talked about it in our second show. So quick side note, I don't know if I had already mentioned this, but Rum Creek was actually Danny Joe Brown's first singing appearance before he became the lead vocalist for Molly Hatchet. And I think it was actually Bobby Ingram who like helped him get that gig. So after Rum Creek and with Molly Hatchet, Ingram brought in his musical influences from Eric Clapton, Alan Collins, John Lennon. And with modern Molly Hatchet, really, Bobby Ingram is the longest standing member of the group. And I believe, yeah, so he's been with them for quite a long, long time. And then up next, we have Phil McCormick, who is from Milwaukee, Wisconsin. He kind of bounced all over the place from like Ohio to Washington, D.C., and then he went over to Virginia. And after all of these locations, he now calls Florida his home. So some of his musical influences were from the Rolling Stones, the Beatles, Greg Allman from the legendary Allman Brothers, and Jimi Hendrix, of course, another legend. And then he was also inspired by my friends, Lynyrd Skynyrd. So before his career with Molly Hatchet, McCormick was already experienced with bands. Obviously, he was involved with a band called the Dixie Road Ducks. And after this group, Phil took his place in Molly Hatchet, showing that he had the potential for one of their frontmen and their singers, and all while displaying the spirit, you know, of the band. So he really executed that job nicely. And McCormick has been the lead vocalist for Hatchet since 1996, and he said that he'll be doing that for the rest of his life, which is awesome because I don't want him going anywhere. And then up next we have Dave Lubeck, who started playing guitar at a very young age, which I kind of, sometimes I wish that there could be like a really famous singer who got started on like a musical instrument late, because when I was little I used to play piano and then I didn't really keep it going, but then I got a guitar and I wanted to learn the guitar and then I never did that. So now at this age I'm like, I really want to get back into guitar, but it's almost like, I don't know, you feel like intimidated because so many people have been playing it since they were so little, but maybe I have a chance, who knows. I just won't be as good as Dave Lubeck. So he's had an extensive career in Southern rock and that whole, you know, genre pretty much. He was already playing guitar from an early age in Jacksonville. He is known as one of the first musical influences to come up from the South, and it gained lots of, you know, insight on rock and roll. And he's also had strong influences for his songwriting and instrumentals, which is just as present now as it was when he first united with Molly Hatchet. And the funny thing about Dave Lubeck is that he actually left the band and he took a pretty long break. After like 20 years, he ended up coming back. So now we have another Ohio native, Mr. John Galvin. He grew up there and he studied jazz and classical piano for about 12 years. And he also stated that when he was 14, he started doing some gigs at fairs and churches and restaurants and stuff, and even skating rinks. So he got started when he was also really, you know, at a young age. And Galvin had a very extensive knowledge of plenty of musical styles that led him to Detroit, where he began playing country music. When he first started with this genre, actually, he didn't really like it too much, but the more he played it, you know, the more it grew on him. So soon country music for John Galvin spread into Southern rock, and that was definitely a new sound for Detroit, since him and his band at that time were the first guys to play any Southern rock material. And after that, they kind of paved the way and opened it up for lots of other local bands who kept it going. So in 1980, that's when John joined Danny Joe Brown along with Bobby Ingram for the Danny Joe Brown Band. And a few years after that, he was invited into Molly Hatchet. And he also took a little bit of a break, but definitely not as long as Dave Lubeck. He came back a lot quicker. And since that brief break, he hasn't gone anywhere. So yay! And now we have another member, Tim Lindsay. He actually toured with Lynyrd Skynyrd for a bit as their bass player. And he's had a part in some other Hall of Famers backing up their music for about 3 decades. So he's always kind of been involved with it. He's a Jacksonville native, born and raised right there in Florida. And during that time, he was developing his musical style with, you know, many influences from the Beatles, Led Zeppelin, Canned Heat, and even Stevie Wonder. So a lot of inspiring artists during that era. There's so much going on in music's history. And Tim Lindsay has had a very long and successful career, always being a music lover and, you know, just an amazing performer. So Lindsay really set super high standards for his profession, and he was frequently involved with some of music's top industry artists. And, you know, it ended with the crazy good Molly Hatchet. So he set that bar pretty darn high. And now the last member of this group, Sean Beamer. This man has been Hatchet's drummer for a while now. He quickly got the name of Thunder when he's on stage. It makes it really clear why they gave him that nickname, because during his live performances, you can really see kind of a thundered characteristic. And his fellow members actually say that he adds a great personality to the band and he puts them in just a really great mood. So that must come in handy when, you know, they're touring and flying all over and being stuck on a plane for God only knows how long. It's always good to have someone like that around to kind of make everything a little bit better. And what I personally love about Beamer is that after years with the band, you can tell he's still so grateful and so honored to be a part of Molly Hatchet. Like, he is always kind of paying homage, I feel like, to the past members. And he said that each time he steps onto stage, he knows he's representing the past and the present members, and that it's so, so important to him. And for me, it's refreshing for me to, you know, to have an artist appreciate all that after such a long time. It's very cool. It still shows that they're still so passionate about what they do. So currently, Molly Hatchet is actually on tour. They started back in February of this year, and they're going till December 22nd. And this 2014 Justice World Tour, by the way, if there's one song that you need to listen to by this band, listen to Justice right now. The song is just, it's an amazing song, and it always results in like a really weird, crazy air guitar solo for me. So definitely listen to that one. Now, this tour began on February 5th in London, England, and so far they've hit most of the United States. They hit a lot of the Dixie states, and then Illinois, Michigan, New Jersey, Indiana, Ohio, Maryland, New York, Pennsylvania, South Dakota. So now South Dakota has the Sturgis Bike Rally and Molly Hatchet, two wonderful things. They should share the love with this state. So pretty much they've been to all of the U.S. except for California. So that sucked for me, but, and my mother actually, for that matter, since she's my new concert partner. And now I believe they're heading over to Orlando, Florida for their performance on the 30th of this month. And then they'll be ending this huge tour in Germany. And that wraps up a little bit about Molly Hatchet currently. So now we are going into our last segment with our last song for today's show. This song is called Mama Cried by Alison Krauss and her band The Union Station. So let's check it out.
Mama cried, cause her little girl
was Alison Krauss in the Union Station with their song Mama Cried. So let's just go ahead. I'm going to like split them apart. So let's talk about Alison Krauss first. We'll start with her. So she's from Illinois, and she caught some attention very quickly at a young age. Again, everyone at a young age today. So when she was 5, she began playing the violin, starting off with classical lessons. And while she was learning, Alison Krauss got kind of bored with the classical sound, so she began performing bluegrass and country tunes. So at 8 years old, she was entering like talent contests around Illinois, and following that, she ended up creating her own band. So in 1983, at just 12 years old, she won the Illinois State Fiddle Championship, resulting in the Society for the Preservation of Bluegrass in America giving her the title of the most promising fiddler in the Midwest. So when she was 14, that's when she actually made her recording debut on Different Strokes, which was an album that appeared on the independent label called Fiddle Tunes. And shortly after that, she was signed to Rounder Records. And I'll remind you again that she was only 14. She makes me feel very, very untalented. So a few years after landing a contract, Alison Krauss released her own debut album called Too Late to Cry, and it featured her backup band, The Union Station. So since that album, Union Station has changed a bit. Members, you know, they left and they were replaced by newcomers. And during that time, they have created Two Highways, Every Time You Say Goodbye. And they actually joined with plenty of others for the Oh Brother, Where Art Thou soundtrack. Definitely check that out. The music from that movie is fantastic. And George Clooney is in it. John Goodman's in it. Holly Hunter also stars in it. So it has a great soundtrack on top of that. And so the band, they've kept performing together and they're producing lots of good music. So now that the band has settled down, let's just go over the current lineup that has been the same for quite a while now. So the members of Union Station are Ron Block, Jerry Douglas, Barry Bales, and Dan Timinsky, all joined by Miss Alison Krauss. So Krauss plays the fiddle and she is on the lead vocals, but as we heard, you know, she's not always on the lead vocals because obviously a guy was singing this song. And Ron Block's instruments are the guitar and the banjo, and he also does some vocals, and he joined the Union Station in 1991. He's also recorded with a couple of other big artists like Brad Paisley and Dolly Parton, for example. And then we have Jerry Douglas, who plays the dobro and is extremely well known for it. Douglas is He's like a world-renowned dobro player, and he's been with the group since 1998. Jerry has gotten 12 Grammy Awards, 3 CMA Awards, and so many International Bluegrass Music Association Awards, and numerous Dobro Player of the Year wins. I literally almost, like, I got a headache from that because I didn't take a breath from that sentence. That's how long all the awards were. So, obviously, this guy can seriously play the dobro. He's like the Yoda of dobros. Next, we have Barry Bales, who has contributed in vocals and played the bass for Alison Krauss and Union Station since 1990. He's also won plenty of awards, including 13 Grammy Awards, a CMA Award. Can you guys like hear me breathing? Like I'm not going to pass out this time. By the way, I don't know if I've mentioned this. CMA is Country Music Association, you know. And Bales was also awarded by the Academy of Country Music, and he has won 11 International Bluegrass Music Association Awards. And to top it off, he won Bass Player of the Year in 2008. And something really cool about Barry Bales, at least I think it's cool, is that he recorded and performed with Merrill Haggard, who is an artist that will be appearing on Good Old Days very soon. So next, to complete this very successful collaboration, we have Mr. Dan Timinsky. He plays the guitar and the mandolin for Union Station, and he joined in 1994. And just adding to the many accomplishments from the members of this band, Timinsky has been named the Male Vocalist of the Year by the International Bluegrass Music Association. I really should have abbreviated this, but IBMA, there, it's shortened. So they gave him that title 4 times. And just like I mentioned before, on the film Oh Brother, Where Art Thou, Dan Timinsky provided the vocals actually for that soundtrack. And he did an awesome job on a classic song from that movie called I Am a Man of Constant Sorrow. And I have that song. So if you want, you could like kind of, I'm just going to fast forward and drop it somewhere. But here, check it out. Here's Dan Timinsky for I Am a Man of Constant Sorrow.
called to old Kentucky, the plains where I was born and raised.
There we go. So that was I'm a Man of Constant Sorrow from Oh Brother, Where Art Thou? And that is Alison Krauss and the Union Station. So incredible, incredible group. Again, if you like bluegrass and you haven't listened to these guys already, then you should really get to it and do that. And that is our show. Once again, I'm Jax, and thank you for stopping by for good old days and for rocking out to some country and rock, and this time some bluegrass. And by the way, I'm going to give myself a pat on the back. Did you notice how many times I said the word success, and it was like perfect, and I didn't mess it up. So woo, yay to me. So have a really good day and a good rest of the week, you guys. And I'll talk to you next Monday at 8 for show number 8 here on radio.dominican.edu. Goodbye.
I'm broken, do you hear me?